$14 billion in the fiscal year 2022-23. Lawmakers reset this figure to 1.4 million BPDs, with $70 a barrel. Any agreement in the ongoing Vienna talks will immediately push Iran's oil sales up by at least 500,000 BPDs as a result of the removal of U.S. oil embargoes on Iran. But lawmakers say they will not wait for the fate of the negotiations to finalize the budget bill, saying any extra petrodollar will be spent for the good of the people.
We cannot waste our time and wait if the U.S. removes the sanctions or not. So we set the budget based on a daily export of 1.4 million barrels of oil through direct or barter sales and based on assumptions that oil prices will hover around $70 when in fact the prices are reaching $100. Any extra oil income will be saved in a national development fund.
President Ebrahim Raisi submitted the budget bill to Parliament in mid-December last year when Parliament approved its general outlines. Lawmakers now have 3 weeks to go over the details and fix the shortcomings of the budget to pass it into law before handing it to the higher legislative body, the Constitutional Council, for final approval. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
EU foreign affairs ministers held talks in Brussels to bolster the 27-nation bloc's second round of new sanctions against Russia over the Kremlin's military campaign in Ukraine.
Only leaders in the world who are sanctioned by the European Union, Assad from Syria, Lukashenko from Belarus, and now Putin from Russia.
Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has also been added to the sanctions list. The idea is to block banks in the EU from making funds available to the two key Russian figures. Earlier on Friday, EU leaders agreed sanctions on Russia's energy, aviation and financial sectors.
We're now targeting 70% of the Russian banking market, but also key state-owned companies, including the field of defence.
Outside the EU leaders' summit, union members staged a peace demonstration.
We don't think to have a war in Ukraine is a good thing for European workers and for Ukrainian workers. So we don't agree with the war.
Leaders from the 30-country NATO alliance held a summit on Friday. The big question is, could moves by the West stoke the flames and turn this crisis into a catastrophe?
NATO allies have and continue to provide support, military, but also different types of equipment to Ukraine.
US troops under the NATO flag have just arrived in Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania. Moscow had requested less provocation from NATO, but it appears those calls continue to fall on deaf ears. According to some analysts, one positive fallout from the crisis could be greater independence for the EU when it comes to foreign policy. The point has been made, there will be a realisation in the coming months. It is dangerous and extremely costly economically to allow Washington dictate relations between neighbours on the other side of the Atlantic. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Afghans gathered to celebrate Eid al-Mabas, an important day in the history of Islam on which the Prophet Muhammad was chosen as God's final messenger and started his prophetic mission. Participants paid tribute to the Grand Prophet of Islam and congratulated Muslims around the globe on this holy occasion.
I congratulate all Muslims worldwide on the anniversary of the Grand Eid al-Mab'ath. Prophet Muhammad was appointed as a messenger to enlighten the world and instruct people how to live. He taught us not to accept slavery and live freely. Afghans have proved that if we follow Islam, no one can defeat us.
Prophet Muhammad, as the final messenger of God, has been the best role model for humankind. He had the best personality and attributes. Prophet Muhammad says that he was sent to teach moral virtues to humanity. He serves as a teacher and as a savior for all Muslims and humanity.
Addressing the ceremony, speakers also emphasized the need for Islamic unity among all Muslims. They said one of the messages of the Prophet of Islam was to fight oppression, injustice, and devils.
We Muslim nations are obliged to follow Prophet Muhammad's path and study his teachings and thoughts. One of his messages to us is to get united. Second, he asks us to resist against devils, oppressors, and arrogant powers. That is when we will succeed.
Tuesday marks the anniversary of the beginning of the prophetic mission of Muhammad Rasulullah. Eid al-Mabas is largely commemorated by the followers of Islam around the globe. As a Muslim nation, Afghans take this opportunity to strengthen the bonds of brotherhood and solidarity. They say the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was a messenger of kindness, peace, and justice. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In the United States, police officers fear retaliation if they step in to stop misconduct by other police officers. In the wake of George Floyd's death, police departments are trying to change that. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Shayla Dewan. The piece is titled, A New Message for Police. If you see something, say something. On an early Monday morning in a chilly classroom in Baltimore, Maryland, a diverse group of recruits to one of the nation's most troubled police departments gathered for a new kind of training. The screen flashed a photo of a man whose face is now familiar to the world. What happened to George Floyd? The instructor barked. He was lynched, one trainee responded. He was murdered, another trainee said. How many other police officers were there? The instructor asked. Many knew the answer. Three. That was the crux of the matter at hand. Not the senior officer who knelt on George Floyd's neck, Derek Chauvin, but the three others who did not stop him. The question of what other police officers could or should have done was not abstract. More than 1,000 miles away, those same three former police officers, two of them ranked rookies, were standing trial on charges that they failed to prevent the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis in May of 2020. On Thursday, they were convicted and could face many years in prison. For decades, many police critics have complained that police officers who allow police misconduct to happen do more damage to the community's trust than the police officers who commit it. Yet, they have not been a focus. When Rodney King was tased and beaten by four Los Angeles police officers in 1991, more than a dozen other police officers looked on. None of the onlookers faced charges. The federal trial of two Tao, J. Alexander Kung and Thomas Lane in Minnesota this month, was one of the rare attempts to hold police officers to account over the issue. The duty to stop a fellow police officer who is engaging in misconduct has long been embedded in many department policies and upheld by the courts of law. But the defendants in Minnesota argued that during their training, it was little more than a word on a PowerPoint. Police officers across the United States have been told they must intervene if they see a fellow police officer behave in misconduct, but they have not necessarily been taught how to do so. George Floyd's death has begun to change that. More than 215 police departments have signed up for a Georgetown University program that teaches police officers the philosophy and techniques of intervention. Watching the Floyd video, you're thinking the only thing that could have snapped any one of those police officers out of it would have been for another one of them to intervene, said Chief Kelly McCarthy of Mendota Heights, a Minneapolis suburb, whose department has begun to use the training. Dallas, Seattle, Los Angeles, Cleveland, Washington, D.C., and all of New Jersey are also participating. Active bystander training is not new. The airline industry and hospitals have used it to empower co-pilots and nurses to speak up to prevent mistakes. And it has even been used to help stop sexual assault on college campuses. Its use in policing began in New Orleans in 2016, after a number of police officers faced criminal charges, including a rookie who went to prison for helping cover up a fatal beating perpetrated by his training officer. But other police departments have been slow to adopt such programs for many reasons. The paramilitary structure of law enforcement agencies discourages questioning the chain of command, and departments have a long track record of retaliating against whistleblowers. Police officers who break the culture of silence risk being passed over for promotions or even being fired themselves, as Carriol Horn in Buffalo, New York was after she stopped a white police officer from choking a black subject. To overcome these barriers, trainees are told that program is not about ratting about their comrades, but stopping them from committing misconduct in the first place. They are told to think of police officers in need of intervention as humans who get tired and stressed and make mistakes, and of themselves as helpers who can respond to warning signs of mental illness, addiction, or suicide. Intervention, the premise goes, it's just one more way that police officers take care of one another. We get an opportunity to redefine this whole freaking thing about the thin blue line, redefine what it means to have each other's back, said Jerry Clayton, the sheriff in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's so hypocritical to criticize the community around no snitching, an unwritten rule on the street that police officers say prevents them from solving crimes. And then we turn around and say, I can talk about that thing that happened. Michael Harrison was the chief who started the training in New Orleans in 2015 with the help of Irvin Staub, a psychologist and Holocaust survivor who has studied the dynamics of bystander intervention. Michael Harrison brought the program with him to Baltimore, Maryland, where he's now the commissioner. At both police departments, he has been charged with correcting a pattern of constitutional violations under agreements with the Justice Department known as consent decrees. Historically, loyalty was looked at as, if I confide in you, you keep my secret, Commissioner Harrison said. We started teaching loyalty should be displayed on the front end to prevent potential injury, death, career ruin, or even worse. The bottom line, he said, let me help you not make this mistake in the first place. In the 2 years after New Orleans trained its police officers, the number of canine bites, police shootings, vehicle chases, and use of force complaints dropped. Because of other changes mandated by the consent decree, it is not clear how much of those declines are attributable to intervention training. But close observers like Jonathan Aroney, the federal monitor, say it helped change department culture. In Baltimore this month, the trainees acted out scenarios that might call for intervention. In one police officer begins an illegal search of a woman's car. In another, a supervisor pressures a police officer to pretend he did not hear a suspect ask for a lawyer, a request that normally would put an end to an interrogation.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's the sixth day of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Tit for tat measures underway while more Ukrainians are fleeing their country. Ukraine's president says defending the capital Kiev is his top priority, while Russia has promised to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. Reacting to developments in Ukraine, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the conflict there is the result of U.S. and Western policies. He cited Ukrainian and former Afghan presidents complaining of Washington leaving them high and dry. Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who's joining us in this edition of The Spotlight. We'll have research fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Zamuela, joining us out of Budapest. Also with us will be independent international affairs analyst, Gilbert Doctora from Brussels.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now let me ask George this question. George, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky tweeted a few days ago that his country was left alone by the US and the EU. Why did they betray Zelensky after Russia attacked Ukraine?
Well, just before I attempt to answer that question, I want to congratulate Gilbert. He was on a few weeks ago with me, and he predicted that this would happen. And most analysts didn't. He did. Well, to answer your question, though, I think that Zelensky was allowed himself to be used by the United States as a battering ram against Russia. I think, unfortunately, that Ukraine was ill-served by the United States and its allies, and this was the inevitable outcome. There was any number of opportunities as the crisis became more intense, particularly when President Putin started speaking about the Russia's red lines. And it should have been clear to the leaders of the West, Macron, Biden, Blinken, and the Germans, that the Russians were serious. And all Zelensky really had to do was at least to make a show of going ahead and talking. They badly let him down. They didn't explain to him that Russia is very serious. Instead, they allowed Ukraine to posture and to make declarations, open declarations, that we're not even going to legitimize the leaders of the Donetsk and Luhansk republics, even though the Minsk agreement explicitly states that the implementation of it requires negotiations between Kiev and the representatives of the Donetsk and Luhansk. They didn't tell him this. They allowed him to shoot his mouth off in Munich about Ukraine becoming a nuclear power. And, as I say, they let him down very badly, and they let Ukraine down very badly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Gilbert, there are people who argue that Ukraine has fallen victim to the West policy, especially those of the U.S. And they argue that the crisis in Ukraine and the ensuing Russian war was instigated by Washington and its post-Cold War expansion of NATO toward Russian borders. What's your take? How do you see the West's role in the war in Ukraine?
Well, the United States, the foreign policy community in Washington, must be delighted that they have lured the Russian forces into a war with Ukraine, which Russia did not want. Mm-hmm. Back in December, Russia highlighted to Washington and to NATO its main concern, which was to sit down at a table and talk about changing the architecture of security in Europe, which for the last 25 years the Russians have found very unsatisfactory, discriminatory, and resulting in ever-increasing threats to their national security through the expansion of NATO to the east. So the NATO question was by itself the number one priority of Russia, and Ukraine was to a certain extent an exhibit A about what NATO was about, why NATO was a threat. Exhibit A has become the whole exhibit at the present, because the issue of Russian security has fallen by the wayside, which delights certainly the power elite in Washington. And yet that is not the case in the final analysis. In the final analysis was proceeding day by day in the Russian operations in Ukraine is an attempt to smash NATO to pieces, because the credibility of NATO, the credibility of the United States, and its security umbrella to all of its charges in NATO is being put to the test. And so far, as your question indicated, the test is being failed by the United States. There was stated before the action began, and as a kind of bait to Russia to act, President Biden said that the United States would never send a soldier to fight to help Ukraine in any war with Russia. This was backed up by other NATO members, and it was perfectly clear that Ukraine was being set up for a disaster. But the United States had no interest in the welfare of Ukraine. That Ukraine is simply a tool that was being used to bait, and if they succeeded, to do great damage to Russian sovereignty and Russian national power.
Now I'm going to ask you a question about that, too. Okay. Now let me ask George about British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's spokesman saying Monday that Western sanctions in retaliation for the invasion of Ukraine are designed to topple Russian President Vladimir Putin. Is the U.S. seeking regime change in Russia?
Yes, I think that's been a fairly explicit policy on the part of the U.S. They've been dreaming of a return to the Gorbachev-Yeltsin era, and they've been frustrated year after year by Putin. I mean, we know this from the Hillary Clinton the time, you know, that was in 2011, that they were clearly organizing protests in Russia. They want Putin out. The problem, I think, is, and I think this is a serious one, which is that there's a increasingly a mood in the West for some kind of a confrontation with Russia. There doesn't seem to be any of the restraint that used to animate Western governments. I mean, when, you know, Eisenhower in 1956 over Hungary, Lyndon Johnson in 68 over Czechoslovakia, and then subsequently, which is there are certain red lines that you don't cross. And you don't even want to start going on that you're going to get into an armed conflict, because that's just going to escalate into a very dangerous area. And unfortunately, too many Western leaders, such as Boris Johnson and Liz Truss and others, are talking openly about getting into some kind of a shooting war with Russia. This is so reckless, so absolutely disastrous, because I think the mood in Russia right now is that war, I mean, among the policymakers, that war with the West is inevitable. It may come now, it may come in 2-3 years, but it is coming. And I think that's a...
Gilbert, we also have a group of analysts who believe that the long-term goal of the crisis in Ukraine is to weaken Russia, you know, as part of Washington's willingness and crave for a unipolar world. Do you agree with them?
Well, yes, to contain Russia and to keep it down, that is clearly the objective. At the same time, coming back to the sanctions that have been imposed, which really match what was called previously the nuclear option, that is, devastating sanctions in the economic sphere, I think that the problem is that in Washington and in Brussels, they really don't understand Russia. They have with Russia as it is, the analytic skills, the intellectual skills to deal with. The economic sanctions are very severe. I think Russia expects them to be, because this conflict will end soon. The threats to Russian security and the regime or the government in place is not in that area. The issue for Russia is the Western press has misunderstood totally and so forth. The Russian concern, the nature of the war as a fratricidal war, as a kind of civil war between two peoples that have a common history and very close relations and great number of intermarriages. Whereas I'm speaking about the Russian and the Ukrainian peoples. Mm-hmm. And for Russia, they have to proceed. The Kremlin has to proceed very carefully in its military operation, not to present mass slaughter in the American way of war, but to do surgical strikes, to destroy military objects, and to destroy those most radical and elements of the fighting forces in Ukraine, namely these battalions like the Azov battalion that is now surrounded in the Mariupol region, and destroy them separately without taking on the ordinary soldiers, all of whom have mothers and girlfriends and perhaps even relatives in Russia, or not to mention without doing significant damage to civilian infrastructure and to civilian people. So the Russian operation is working under constraints that have nothing to do with what Mr. Macron said thought he was imposing on Vladimir Putin when they had their telephone call 2 days ago. Russia is proceeding with supreme caution, and the operation is taking longer and is more difficult than the American way of war, which is to march through with shock and awe and kill everything on your path.
And they call it peripheral damage.
Collateral damage of hundreds of thousands of civilians. Yes.
Now, George, Russia's war on Ukraine, many believe, has revealed glaring hypocrisies and racism that Western media and governments are fueling. Let me cite you an example that caused great anger, at least here in West Asia. Maybe you've seen that CBS News senior correspondent, Charlie Diagata. He was reporting from Ukrainian capital Kiev on Friday. He said, I'm quoting him, "This isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan. It has seen conflict raging for decades. This is a relatively civilized, relatively European country." End of quote. So what is said is dehumanization of people of color and race and normalization of white supremacy, plain and simple, is it not?
Well, I think there is something of that. But, you know, you could also say that the dehumanization of Russians, and before that the dehumanization of Serbs, was nonetheless played an important role in Western thinking. There is clearly a feeling that the Slavs, such as Russians and such as Serbs, are, you know, you don't want to use the old German expression Untermenschen, but you know, that's more or less what they think. So that's why when you think of what Russia is doing today is basically much, much less destructive than what the United States did in Iraq, what the United States did in Afghanistan, what NATO did in Yugoslavia. I mean, we've had 5-6 days, and although the media are trying to whip up hysteria about the horrific civilian casualties, they don't have much to work with. And basically, there hasn't been anything of the scale of those U.S.-led operations that I refer to. So why is everyone so indignant? Well, because it's the Russians. Russians don't have the same rights and prerogatives as we Westerners do. When we do it, that's fine. But when they do it, it isn't. And that's in the same thing goes by with all this a lot of heated talk about violations of international law. Well, the United States has been violating international law left, right, and center. Yet never once has anyone tried to impose sanctions on the United States. Never once has the United States been banned from sporting competitions. Never once has the United States oligarchs or very rich people been subjected to sanctions. So there's a very much a different set of standards that apply to the Westerners and to Russians.
Right. Now, on that note, let me ask Gilbert this question. Gilbert, the U.S. and its allies wage unprovoked wars and invasions in several countries, Afghanistan, Iraq, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, Palestine, and Yemen, and this without any U.N. authorization. It killed many people. So are we witnessing a good war, bad war dichotomy here? I mean, how do you explain this hypocrisy?
Well, hypocrisy is the small change of diplomacy everywhere in the world. It has been and it will be. So I wouldn't be in a state of shock over the double standards. That's to be expected. And I don't think that in the Kremlin they are suffering too much from any of the sanctions. You'll notice that the Russians have not responded to these sanctions, other than the banning of airspace, where they responded at once, but to the nuclear option attacks on the central bank of Russia and so forth. They have so far done nothing. And that tells you that they don't believe that these sanctions will long endure, and that they have in reserve compensatory sanctions that they are ready to impose if necessary. But there are no rush to do that. Now, what am I talking about? We all know that the BP has said it's going to divest its shares in Rosneft, which are about 20% of Rosneft and are worth at least $25 billion. They will take a beating on that, take a terrible loss, because it's hard to think who exactly, other than the Chinese, are going to stand up and present them with a check to buy their shares. That is the least of it. In the Russians, if they want to respond in like, can confiscate all of European property in Russia, which far exceeds in value whatever is being frozen in Russian assets in the West. But the Russians haven't been in haste to use those countermeasures, because they don't believe that this hysteria that we see today will last beyond a couple of weeks, during which time the problems will be resolved, including the whole question of Europe giving a fast-track admittance to Ukraine. Fast-track normally would mean 18 months. Ukraine, as it presently looks, will be lucky to stay in one piece beyond 2 or 3 weeks, after which it will probably be divided, reluctantly divided, by Russia, in collaboration with local people who are willing to work in and lead the new states.
Yeah. George, did you hear Gilbert's prediction? We'll wait for another 2-3 weeks and see if that comes true, too. Okay, that was my last question, of course, but you just mentioned it now. Now, George, let's talk a little bit about the way European countries have been welcoming Ukrainians and fleeing the war in their country with open arms, which is, of course, a good thing. But they did not treat refugees from Middle East and Africa in, let's say, 2021. They were fleeing wars in their countries, and those wars were caused by the U.S. and NATO. They were responsible for that. Can you shed some light on this?
Well, I think it goes back to your earlier point about hypocrisy. I mean, if you remember, a couple of months ago, we had another bout of hysteria about this was involved Poland and Belarus, and the Poles were absolutely beside themselves over the prospect of 3,000 refugees or migrants or whatever you will coming across the border from Belarus, and the EU was indignant about it, and NATO, and everybody condemned Belarus, and of course by implication Russia, that these people were on the border, and in fact Poland unleashed a cold water hose. This was late November, so that's pretty nasty. And again, you know, everyone just blamed Belarus and Russia. So yes, there's very much double standards, and it's you know, even applies to Viktor Orban, you know, who's been the great champion in Europe of saying no to migrants. He apparently is welcoming migrants from Ukraine.
Okay, now Gilbert, we have only 30 seconds if you want to add to your comments, especially your prediction.
Well, it's very difficult to be wise. The situation on the ground changes. I believe that Mr. Putin and his immediate advisors are extremely flexible and have been revising and will continue to revise both strategy and tactics depending on what they see on the ground. And so for us on the sidelines as commentators, it is extremely difficult to predict with any degree of reliability what will happen 2 or 3 weeks from now. But there are just some indications, as I said, that a likely split up of the Ukraine supervised by the Russians is in the cards. Whether that happens will depend on the rulers in Kiev presently and how they react to the Russian advances.
Okay, and that note, we come to the end of this show. Let me thank our guests. We had Senior Research Fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Zamueli in Budapest, and Independent International Affairs Analyst, Gilbert Doctor in Brussels. I've been your host, Behruz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
On IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Recent scientific research has found that by 2050, the key drivers of major climate change will be feedback loops at both ends of the temperature spectrum. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alfred W. McCoy, writer. This article is published under the heading, Melting of Ice Sheets is Dramatic, but Melting of Permafrost Means Mass Death. Stay tuned for more. When midnight strikes on New Year's Day of 2050, there will be little cause for celebration. But for most of humanity, it will just be another day of adversity bordering on misery, a desperate struggle to find food, water, shelter, and safety. In the previous decades, storm surges will have swept away coastal barriers erected at enormous cost, and rising seas will have flooded the downtowns of major cities that once housed more than 100 million people. Relentless waves will pound shorelines around the world, putting villages, towns, and cities at risk. As several hundred million climate change refugees in Africa, Latin America, and South Asia feel leaky boats or trash overland in a desperate search for food and shelter, affluent nations worldwide will be trying to shut their borders even tighter, pushing crowds back in tear gas and gunfire. Yet those reluctant host countries, including the United States, won't faintly be immune from the pain. Every summer, in fact, ever more powerful hurricanes propelled by climate change will pummel the East and U.S. Gulf Coast of this country, possibly even forcing the federal government to abandon Miami and New Orleans to the rising tides. Meanwhile, wildfires, already growing in size in 2021, will devastate vast stretches of the West, destroying thousands upon thousands of homes every summer and fall in an ever-expanding fire season. This dismayed vision of life circa 2050 comes not from some flight of literary fantasy, but from published environmental science. Indeed, we can all see the troubling signs of global warming around us right now, worsening wildfires, ever more severe ocean storms, and increased coastal flooding.
While the world is focused on the fiery spectacle of wildfires destroying swathes of Australia, Brazil, California and Canada, a far more serious threat is developing, only half attended to. In the planet's remote polar regions, not only are the ice caps melting with frightening speed, already raising sea levels worldwide, but the vast Arctic permafrost is fast receding, releasing enormous stores of lethal greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. At that frozen frontier far beyond our ken or consciousness, ecological changes brewing largely invisibly deep beneath the Arctic tundra will accelerate global warming in the ways sure to inflict untold future misery on all of us. More than any of other place or problem, the thawing of Arctic frozen earth, which covers vast parts of the roof of the world, will shape humanity's fate for the rest of the century, destroying cities, devastating nations, and rupturing the current global order. In assessing the likely course of climate change by 2050, one question is paramount. How quickly will we feel its impact? For decades, scientists thought that climate change would arrive at what science writer Eugene Linden called stately pace. In 1975, the U.S. National Academies of Sciences still felt that it would take centuries for the climate to change in a meaningful way. As late as 1990, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, concluded that the Arctic permafrost, which stores both staggering amounts of carbon dioxide, CO2, and methane, an even more dangerous greenhouse gas, was not yet melting and that the Antarctic ice sheets remained stable. In 1993, however, scientists began studying ice cores extracted from Greenland's ice cap and found that there had been 25 rapid climate change events in the last glacial period thousands of years ago, showing that the climate could change massively within a decade or two. Driven by a growing scientific consensus about the dangers facing humanity, representatives of 196 states met in 2015 in Paris, where they agreed to commit themselves to a 45% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 and achieve net carbon neutrality by 2050 to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. This, they argued, would be sufficient to avoid the disastrous impacts sure to come at 2 degrees Celsius degrees or higher. However, the bright hopes of that Paris conference faded quickly. Within 3 years, the scientific community realized that the cascading effects of global warming reaching 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels would be evident not in the distant future of 2100, but perhaps by 2040, impacting most adults alive today. The medium-term effects of climate change will only be amplified by the uneven way the planet is warming, with a far heavier impact in the Arctic. According to a Washington Post analysis, by 2018, the world already had hot spots that had recorded an average rise of 2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial norm. As the sun strikes tropical latitudes, huge columns of warm air rise and then are pushed toward the poles by greenhouse gases trapped in the atmosphere until they drop down to Earth at higher latitudes, creating spots with faster rising temperatures in the West Asia region, Western Europe, and above all, the Arctic. In a 2018 IPCC Doomsday report, its scientists warned that even at just 1.5 degrees Celsius, temperature increases would be unevenly distributed globally and could possibly reach a devastating 4.5 degrees Celsius in the Arctic high altitudes, with profound consequences for the entire planet. Recent scientific research has found that by 2050, the key drivers of major climate change will be feedback loops at both ends of the temperature spectrum. At the hotter end in Africa, Australia, and the Amazon, warmer temperatures will spark ever more devastating forest fires, reducing tree cover and releasing vast amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. This in turn, as is already happening, will fuel yet more fires and so create a monstrous self-reinforcing feedback loop that could decimate the great tropical rainforests of this planet. The even more serious and uncontrollable driver, however, will be in the planet's polar regions. There, an Arctic feedback loop is already gaining a self-sustaining momentum that could soon move beyond humanity's capacity to control it. By mid-century or before, as ice sheets continue to melt disastrously in Greenland and Antarctica, rising oceans will make extreme sea level events like once-in-a-century storm surges and flooding annual occurrences in many areas. If global warming grows beyond the maximum 2 degrees Celsius target set by the Paris Agreement, depending on what happens to Antarctica's ice sheets, ocean levels could increase by a staggering 43 inches as this century ends. In fact, a worst-case scenario by the National Academies of Sciences projects a sea level rise of as much as 20 inches by 2050 and 78 inches in 2100, with a catastrophic loss of 690,000 square miles of land and expanse 4 times the size of California, displacing about 2.5% of the world's population and inundating major cities like New York. Adding to such concerns, a recent study in Nature predicted that by 2060, rain rather than snow could dominate parts of the Arctic, further accelerating ice loss and raising sea levels significantly. Moving that doomsday ever closer, recent satellite imagery reveals that the ice shelf holding back Antarctica's massive De Weisse Glacier could shatter within 3 to 5 years, quickly breaking that Florida-sized frozen mass into hundreds of icebergs and eventually resulting in several feet of sea level rise on its own.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.